Continue with the Adi Parva, section 2. After this hath been recited, the highly pathetic Parva called Stri, Dhritarashtra, prophetic eye, afflicted at the death of his children, and moved by enmity towards Bhima, broke into pieces the statue of hard iron deftly placed before him by Krishna as a substitute of Bhima. Then Vidura, removing the distressed Dhritarashtra's affection for worldly things by reasons pointing to final release, consoled the wise monarch. Then hath been described the wending of the distressed Dhritarashtra, accompanied by the ladies of his house to the field of battle of the Kauravas. Here follow the pathetic wailings of the wives of the slain heroes. Then the wrath of Gandhari and Dhritarashtra and their loss of consciousness. Then the Kshatriya ladies saw those heroes, their unreturning sons, brothers, and fathers lying dead on the field. Then the pacification by Krishna of the wrath of Gandhari, distressed at the death of her sons and grandsons. Then the cremation of the bodies of the deceased rajas with due rites by that monarch, Yudhishthira, of great wisdom, and the foremost also of all virtuous men. Then upon the presentation of water of the manes of the deceased princes having commenced, the story of Kunti's acknowledgement of Karna as her son, born in secret. Those have all been described by the great Rishi Vyas in the highly pathetic 11th Parva. Its perusal moveth every feeling heart with sorrow, and even draweth tears from the eyes. The number of sections composed is 27. The number of shlokas is 775. 12th in number cometh the Shanti Parva, which increaseth the understanding, and in which is related the despondency of Yudhishthira on his having slain his fathers, brothers, sons, maternal uncles, and matrimonial relations. In this Parva is described how, from his bed of arrows, Bhishma expounded various systems of duties worth the study of kings desirous of knowledge. This Parva expounded the duties related to emergencies with full indications of times and reasons. By understanding these, a person attaineth to consummate knowledge. Right, so in other words, you have knowledge of how to run things, but if you don't know how to run things in emergency, you don't actually know how to run things. Right? Because the material world, a lot of times, is emergencies. So it's only then that you truly understand, because in emergency, you understand what it is you're trying to get done, rather than the ritual itself. Does that make sense? So that means then you have an understanding of actually what is the attainment of this particular activity. Right? Otherwise you think the ritual is actually the goal. No, the ritual has a goal. So in emergencies, then you start to be able to understand the ritual, actually what's the essential point, so that that is gained, even though that particular ritual may not be followed. You may have to use some other substitute. Does that make sense? So that's actual knowledge. Memorization of rules is the first step, but actually understanding how to apply it in all time, place, and circumstance, that's actual knowledge. Yeah? The mysteries also of final emancipation have been expiated upon. Oh. expatiated. This is the 12th parva, the favorite of the wise. It consists of 339 sections and contains 14,732 shlokas, so quite thick. Huh? It's the biggest so far, yeah. Now, because all this is all just wise knowledge, like how to manage the kingdom and how to attain, you know, get out of the material world like that. So these are very, very important. Next in order is the excellent Anushasana Parva. In it is described how Yudhishthira, the king of the Kurus, was reconciled to himself on hearing the exposition of duties by Bhishma, the son of Bhagirathi. This parva treats of rules in detail and of dharma and artha. Then the rules of charity and its merits. Then the qualifications of donis, means persons that you give to, right? You can't just give money to anybody. There's qualifications. And the supreme rule regarding gifts. This parva also describes the ceremonials of individual duty, the rules of conduct, and the matchless merit of truth. This parva showeth the great merit of brahmanas and kind, and unraveleth the mysteries of duties in relation to time and place. These are embodied in the excellent parva called Anushasana, a varied incidence. In this hath been described the ascension of Bhishma to heaven. This is the 13th parva, which hath laid down accurately the various duties of men. The number of sections in this is 146. The number of shlokas is 8,000. Right, so it's showing that duties, specifically what are the individual duties, then time, place, and circumstance. So we've already heard what's the overall, then within that how it is. Because you have to know what an individual does, what the other individual does, what's your relationship, and then how that fits into the whole social structure. Does that make sense? So all that has to be known. Then comes the 14th parva, Ashramedika. And this is the excellent story of Sambarta and Maruta. Then is described the discovery by the Pandavas of golden treasures, and then the birth of Parikit, who was revived by Krishna after having been burnt by the celestial weapon of Ashwatthaman. The battles of Arjuna, the son of Pandu, while following the sacrificial horse let loose, with various princes who in wrath seized it. Then is shown the great risk of Arjuna in his encounter with Prabhu Vahan, the son of Chitrangada, by Arjuna, the appointed daughter of the chief of Manipura. Right? She's the appointed daughter. That means, even though it's his, it means he's the father of the son, technically he's not the legal father. Right? Because Chitrangada's father appointed her, so she's an appointed daughter, right? So that's known before marriage. So an appointed daughter means her son becomes technically her father's son, right? So the father doesn't have a son. And so in the Vedic age, you had to perform the Shraddha rites. That was important, right? Vaishnavas don't have to worry about that. But in the Vedic age, that was very important. So then, without a son, then if you only had a daughter, then the daughter would be appointed. Her son would then be the one who performs the Shraddha rites for the father. Right? He would do it anyway as the grandfather, but then you're already grandfather, because by great grandfather you're out of the circle. Right? So this way then you have the son, then his son, then his grandfather, then his great grandfather, then you're out. Right? So that's how it goes. So there's only four people that are involved: the person offering the Shraddha, his father, and the father before that. Does that make sense? So that's why it says the son of Chitrangada, and then in brackets it says by Arjuna, because it's technically not his son, right? Then the story of the mongoose during the performance of the horse sacrifice. This is the most wonderful parva, called Ashramedika. The number of sections is 103. The number of shlokas comprised in this by Vyas of true knowledge is 3,320. Right? Means this mongoose came, and he was half golden and half ordinary mongoose. So he came at the sacrifice at the end and rolled on the ground on the side that was not gold, and then got up And then I think saw that it wasn't gold. They were wondering, what's going on here? And he mentioned the story of some great king before, how his Ashwamedha Yajna, when he had come and for some reason rolled on the ground, the side that touched the ground turned golden. So since then, every Ashwamedha Yajna that's been performed, he goes to see if it's of the same standard so that he can turn the other half golden. Right? Then comes the 15th parva called Ashram Vasika. In this, Dhritarashtra, abdicating the kingdom and accompanied by Gandhari and Vidura, went to the woods. Seeing this, the virtuous Prita also, ever engaged in cherishing her superiors, leaving the court of her sons, followed the old couple. In this is described the wonderful meeting through the kindness of Vyas, of the king, Dhritarashtra, with the spirits of his slain children, grandchildren, and other princes, returned from the other world. Then the monarch, abandoning his sorrows, acquired with his wife the highest fruit of his meritorious actions. In this parva, Vidura, after having leaned on virtue all his life, attaineth to the most meritorious state. The learned son of Gavalgana, Sanjaya, also of passions under full control, and the foremost of ministers, attained in the parva to the blessed state. In this, Yudhishthira the just met Narada and heard from him about the extinction of the race of Rishnis. This is the very wonderful parva called Ashram Vasika. The number of sections is 42, and the number of shlokas composed by Vyas, cognizant of truth, is 1,506. After this, you know, comes the Moshala of painful incidences. In this, those lion-hearted heroes of the race of Vishnu, with the scars of many afield on their bodies, oppressed with the curse of a brahmana, while deprived of reason from drink, impelled by the fates, slew each other on the shores of the salt sea with the Araka grass, which in their hands became invested with the fatal attributes of the thunder. In this, both Balaram and Keshava, Krishna, after causing the extermination of their race, their hour having come, themselves did not rise superior to the sway of all destroying time. In this, Arjuna, the foremost amongst men, going to Dwaravati, Dwarka, and seeing the city destitute of the Vrishnis, was most affected and became exceedingly sorry. Then, after the funeral of his maternal uncle Vasudeva, the foremost amongst the Yadus, Rishnis, he saw the heroes of the Yadu race lying stretched in death on the spot where they had been drinking. He then caused the cremation of the bodies of the illustrious Krishna and Balaram, and of the principal members of the Rishni race. Then he was journeying from Dwarka with the women and children, the old and the decrepit, the remnants of the Yadu race. He was met on the way by a heavy calamity. He witnessed also the disgrace of his bow Gandiva and the unpropitiousness of his celestial weapons. Seeing all this, Arjuna became despondent and, pursuant to Vyasa's advice, went to Yudhishthira and solicited permission to adopt the sannyas mode of life. This is the 16th parva called Moshala. The number of sections is 8, and number of shlokas composed by Vyas, cognizant of truth, is 320. The next is you also notice here is that what's important is the completeness of a particular presentation or thought, right? So some of them, the completeness takes 14,000 shlokas, and like here, this is only 320. Right? So that, therefore, whenever you're doing teaching knowledge, you do it according to what's connected to each other. Don't worry that all the sections aren't the same size. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the importance is what is complete in itself, not just the layout of the book. You know what I'm saying? Layout is there to add to understanding. Does that make sense? So this is a complete parva, meaning the big 18 parvas. This is not subsection 100 parvas. right? And it's only 300. Well, there's other, some subsections are way bigger than 300. Like that. Seth? The next is Mahaprasannika, the 17th parva. In this, those foremost amongst men, the Pandavas, abdicating their kingdom, went with Draupadi on their great journey called Mahaprasthana. Mahaprasthan means you walk to the northeast and you don't eat. You can drink water, but you don't eat. And so basically you just walk until you collapse. That's Mahaprasthan. In this, they came across Agni, having arrived on the shore of the Sea of Red Waters. The red parting of the Red Sea. In this, asked by Agni himself, Arjuna worshipped him duly, returned to him the excellent celestial bow called Gandiva. In this, leaving his brothers who dropped one after another, and Draupadi also, Yudhishthira went on his journey without once looking back on them. This is the 17th parva called Mahaprasthanika. The number of sections in this is 3. The number of shlokas also composed by Vyas, cognizant of truth, is 320. Well, that's exactly the same as the last one. Here also is that when one's leaving, one has to not look back. Because here, everyone is trying to attain to perfection. So that perfection is not found here, right? It's found by connecting here to there. But there is actually what you're trying to attain. So that would mean at the time of leaving that the point is one doesn't think of one's friends and relatives, right? One thinks of Krishna and the pure devotees. Okay, if your friends and relatives happen to be pure devotees, that's another thing. But that's not what one does. So here Yudhishthira does not look back. His brothers and that fall away. Draupadi falls away. There's no, oh, my Draupadi, oh, my dear brother. Because that's not what they're there for. They're there to go back to Godhead. It means they've already spent a life of engaging those emotions in the Lord's service. Right? So at this moment you don't do that. Otherwise you'll have to spend another lifetime of doing that. Right? So for that austerity of not looking back for those few moments or that short time, you go back to Godhead. Right? Then it's eternal. Then you can meet those particular loved ones there. Right? When they go back to Godhead. Does that make sense? And then eternally you'd be together. Otherwise, you come back here, you can't guarantee that your consciousness and theirs is matched up, that you're actually going to end up even knowing each other. Right? Does that make sense? So, why risk it? One, you're not with them, and you didn't go back to Godhead. Right? Not so good. Right? Right? You go back to Godhead, you will also be with them. Much better. Right? Does that make sense? The parva that comes after this, you must know, is the extraordinary one called Svarga, of celestial incidents. Then seeing the celestial car come to take him, Yudhishthira, moved by kindness towards the dog that accompanied him, refused to ascend it without his companion. Observing the illustrious Yudhishthira's steady adherence to virtue, Dharma, the god of justice, abandoning his canine form, showed himself to the king. Then Yudhishthira, ascending to heaven, felt much pain. The celestial messenger showed him hell by an act of deception. Then Yudhishthira, the soul of justice, heard the heart-rending lamentations of his brothers, abiding in that region under the discipline of Yama. Then Dharma and Indra showed Yudhishthira the region appointed for sinners. Then Yudhishthira, after leaving the human body by a plunge in the celestial Ganges, attained to that region which his acts merited, and began to live in joy, respected by Indra and all other gods. This is the 18th parva, as narrated by the illustrious Vyas. The number of shlokas composed, O ascetics, by the great Rishi in this is 209. The above are the contents of the 18 parvas. In the appendix, Kila, are the Harivansa and Bhavishya. Oh, okay, so these are appendices. The number of shlokas contained in the Harivamsa is 12,000. Appendix. Okay. Harivamsa? Yeah. These are the contents of the section called Parva Sangraha. Means that this second section, the second pada. Sauti continued, 18 Akshauhinis of troops came together for battle. The encounter that ensued was terrible and lasted for 18 days. He who knows the four Vedas with all the Angas and Upanishads but does not know this history, Bharata, cannot be regarded as wise. Vyas of immeasurable intelligence has spoken of the Mahabharata as a treatise on Artha and Dharma and on Kama. Those who have listened to this history can never bear to listen to others, as, indeed, they who have listened to the sweet voice of the male Kokila can never hear the dissonance of the crows cawing. Yeah, you get them both. Right? As the formation of the three worlds proceedeth from the five elements, so do the inspirations of all poets proceed from this excellent composition. O ye Brahmana, as the four kinds of creatures, Vivi Pavaris, Ovi Pavaris, born of heart moisture and vegetables. Right? Means those born from the womb, those born from eggs, those born from hot moisture, you know, it means it's a hot, wet place. And those born, how you say, all your plants, the varieties of plants, are dependent upon space for their existence. So the Puranas depend upon this history. As all senses depend for their exercise upon the various modifications of the mind, so do all acts, ceremonials, and moral qualities depend upon this treatise. See, he's giving here is that in Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Kama, he's also mentioned of the moksha, that the essence of all that's given here in the Mahabharata. Right? And so, even though you know all the other literatures, if you don't know the Mahabharata, then the full understanding of the Vedas and their sub-branches may not be understood. Right? Does that make sense? So, you know, he's pointing out it's the greatest of poetry, and he's saying that the Puranas depend upon it, because the real essence of what's even given in the stories, because they're the same stories, always the same stories are there. All the Puranas, the Mahabharata, they all give the same stories. Just different kalpas or different angles on the story. But they're all the same stories. So then you understand actually what's the essence. Yes. They did, but it was just to show the glory of Yudhishthira, that even though he's the most qualified to go to heaven, then he decided, since they were supposedly by deception in hell, he decided he would stay there with them. Right? Does that make sense? So as soon as he made that, choice, then immediately that illusion of hell disappeared, and then they were in heaven. Yeah? So all they're showing is the greatness of Yudhishthira under any situation, because technically this is an itihas, right? Purana means it's all history, right? You're just going through all the lists of all the personalities, basically in a chronological order, right? You have Brahma, then the Prajapatis, then the Manus, and then all the great kings, right? So now in this, then... it's not focusing on any one particular person, right? It may have a theme, but there's no particular person. Itihas means it's a history of a particular person, like Ramayana is of Lord Ramachandra. So this one is the focus is on Yudhishthira, right? Does that make sense? So then we see, you know, his forefathers and all stories connected. You see the whole universe from it. That's the amazing thing, but it's still an itihas. So you're showing the greatness of Yudhishthira. Means whether he was in the forest, whether he was the emperor of the world, So whether he's insulted, whether he is respected, you know, whether he's going back to Godhead, whether he's going to heaven, or whether he's going to hell, his character remains the same. Right? So that's standard. You know, that's the example. That's the perfect example. Yeah. Is that okay?
Maharaj, before you mentioned the Mahaprasthanika,
a little louder.
You mentioned the Mahaprasthanika,
uh-huh,
that they keep on walking until they just fall down. Yeah. So they don't have any funeral rites for them?
Generally, these ones, you're out in the forest. No, you don't. That's the whole point. You're getting away from all that. Right?
Also, Maharaj, you guys said that if you don't have funeral rites, the person who left his body,
if you don't have funeral rites, but the son, someone else will perform the rites. You may not be present, but you know, they'll perform the rites. So that's the whole point. The vanaprastha sannyas, they just detach themselves. They're not worried about the family social etiquettes. Right? Vanaprastha still interact with it to some degree, but from a detached standpoint. In other words, sannyasis go to the forest. The vanaprasthas go to the edge of the village or to the edge of the forest, but they're available. But the sannyasis are not obliged to be available. Right? They can be, they don't have to be. But vanaprasthas are. But they're out on the outer edge. So does that make sense? So because they have so much experience in the material, you know, sphere of duties, so they can give very nice advice. But they themselves are not involved in it. Does that make sense? Like that. Okay. Yeah. And so now it mentions all the Puranas are dependent because the essence of the Puranas is given in the Mahabharata, right? Because the Puranas were done first and then was done the Mahabharata. Yes. The solar and the lunar dynasty means they're coming down from the sun god or they're coming down from the moon god, right? Tapati was one of that I know of was one of the wives of the sun god, so that's why you'll see when Chitrarata was addressed Arjuna, he called him Tapati, right? Because he was the what Tapati means. What would the mother's name be? Tapa or something. So that line came down from there. So from the sun and then it comes down. So that's how it comes. Then the moon means it comes down from the moon dynasty. So the thing is the sun dynasty is always the leaders. They're always the emperors. And the moon dynasty, they may be very great kings, but generally they always follow the sun dynasty. You know, I think in some occasions they may become prominent if there is no one from the Sun Dynasty. But like Ramachandra's Sun Dynasty, the Pandavas' Sun Dynasty, right? Yayati, Shantanu, all that line that we generally hear of is Sun Dynasty. Like Vikramaditya, you don't hear much of him, but though he was such a great king, but he's Moon Dynasty. Right? And in the histories, you don't hear that much of what happens at Dorka, because it's Moon Dynasty. Right? Though they may be very great and powerful, but they're heard of less because of not being as prominent as the sun. Is that okay? That's why Arjuna used to joke with Krishna that he was Yadava, because that means him as Pandava or Kaurava is superior. Right? So even though they're friends as equals, in equals you always have chivalry. Right? When you have friends that are equal, there's chivalry. You know what I'm saying? So that's how you know they're equal. You know, like you must know that, like, sometimes you have little girls in your school and each one is trying to prove who's in charge. So that actually shows that they're all equal. No one's in charge. Because if they were in charge, you wouldn't have to prove it. Does that make sense? So equals are always having to say who's better and this and that and all those kind of things like that. Does that make sense? So you'll find the chivalry in that area as equals. That's why out on the battlefield, because the Kshatriyas are only seen as Kshatriyas. Otherwise, if it's Drona and Arjuna, how can they fight? Because he's superior. But no, just everybody is Kshatriyas. Therefore, then the Shudra's mood can be there. Therefore, they can fight. Does that make sense? Like that. So then the Puranas, the essence, after the Puranas were already written, the Mahabharata is composed. And that gives the essence of everything, right? So then you can say in this way the Puranas are dependent upon the Mahabharata. But then this shows the most superiority of the Bhagavat Purana, because all the other Vedic literatures, their understanding, you know, the true understanding is actually dependent upon somebody understanding the Mahabharata. Then you get the proper perspective. But to get the proper perspective on Mahabharata, you have to read the Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? Does that make sense? So that places it as the superior literature. Does that make sense? Because here the Mahabharata is establishing itself as the superior literature over all the other Vedic literatures, the essence. Right? And then in the Bhagavatam, then that establishes that it is even superior to that. Does that make sense? Yeah. This is an important point. There is not a story current in the world that doth depend upon this history. Yes. It's a Purana. It's in the Puranas. Means the 14 books, then you have the 4 Vedas, the 6 Vedangas, and the 4 Upangas. So in the Upangas you have the Mimamsa, which is philosophies gained from the Vedic literature. Right? It's called Mimamsa. We say Vedanta because we know that the actual conclusion of the Vedas is given in the Upanishads. And then the essence of that's given in Vedanta Sutra. So that's real Mimamsa. But there are others who take the Mimamsa from the Brahmanas or from the Aranyakas. So they come up with different philosophies. They're not trying to go back to Godhead. Like Purva Mimamsa, that of Jaimini, they just want to always perform pious activities so you're always enjoying. Right? They understand the soul is eternal, so if you always perform pious activities, you'll always be in a good situation. That's their idea. But even the best arranged thing, something goes wrong, right? Like we see with Yudhishthira. He never did anything wrong, but a lot didn't go nice for him. Right? So just piety is not enough. Bhakti is the one that can give the final solution of eternal happiness. Right? So karma can never do it. Right? Does that make sense? But that's based on the Brahmanas, because the Brahmanas show how to do the Vedic sacrifices for pious activities to go to the heavenly planets. Does that make sense? So that's why in general it's called that, though amongst ourselves we'll call it Vedanta. Right? Then you have logic, Nyaya, that supports that, because the Mimamsa has to be logically presented. Right? Then you have Dharma, Dharma Shastras, which then give the social codes, social and religious codes. How, you know, in other words, the Dharma, Artha, and Kama, how it all functions. But this is all the science of it, the rules of it. Then you have Purana, right? The final of them is Purana. That's the biggest of all of them, because it has all the 18 Puranas, the Upa Puranas. It has in there the Itihasas, the Upa Vedas. You know, the Gandharva Veda, Ayur Veda, Stapana Veda, Dhanra Veda. It has all the 64 arts. So as far as the vastness of knowledge, it's the biggest. Like that. Does that make sense? So the Bhagavatam is written in that style because that's the most kind of like attractive and relatable, especially in this age, because of the stories. It keeps one's attention. The example of what you want to learn is already being given. You don't give a philosophical point, then have to give an example. The philosophical point is given in the story, right? Or the cultural point, or like that. Does that make sense? So therefore it's the best, and it's the essence of everything. So then it's the essence of the whole Veda. It's the actual Vedanta in story form. Well, Vedanta Sutra is the Vedanta in sutra form. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's a Mahapurana, but the 18 Puranas are all Mahapuranas. Then you have Upapuranas, which aren't Maha. Like that. They just deal with a certain group of you know, the kings and Prajapatis and all that. Like Nrisimha Purana is not a Mahapurana. It's an Upapurana. But it's an Upapurana within the Setvik, like that. So there's a few. There's Hari Bhakti Shuddha Doi, I think. The, what's it called? It's especially on Varnashram, the Shris use it. That's another major. We wake up our pandit here. Upapurana, major one. It's always connected with Vishnu Purana. Say again? Yeah, the Vishnu Dharmotra. Like that. That really gets into like the whole you know, basically how to connect one's life nicely to Vishnu, but it's not as complete. It's specifically on just a more limited topic. So there's the Upapuranas. So like that, there's many. But of the Mahapuranas, then the last to be written is the Bhagavatam. So it's the final of all the literature written. So you had all the Vedas, all the everything else written. Then Mahabharata was written. It means that was Vyasa's idea of the conclusion of the Vedic literatures. But because of the nature of it, means we see in these, the nature of it, you lose actually the Krishna consciousness, right? We see in the presentation of these essences and the first two padas that Krishna is quite prominent and spiritual life is quite prominent. But when you get into the stories, it's so far between these essential points. Now there's the 25,000 verses that are the actual main Mahabharata. There's so many stories in between. You may have hundreds of thousands of verses between other points that actually bring out the Krishna consciousness. So the tendency will, by volume, you'll forget, right? Because the common people work on volume, right? Everybody does it, right? The Brahman doesn't care if nobody does it. Shastra says he does it, right? But the common person, others are doing it, well, that's more important. So if everybody's doing it, then I have to do it. Does that make sense? So by volume of verses that apparently are not necessarily Krishna conscious, they're just dealing with Dharma, Artha, and Kama, then one tends to be influenced by them over the essential points that may only come here and there. Therefore, the Bhagavatam is written that every syllable is essence and is connected to Krishna. So there's nothing not connected. So then it's very obvious, you know, hey, this is about Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? Is that okay?
Are there 10, the 14 books, are there 10 books in expansion?
Technically speaking, you would say that there's the four Vedas. And that is the knowledge. That's apurusheya. It means spoken only. It means it's not been written by anyone. It's just coming from the Lord. It's His breathing. Then the other 10 books, yes, are based on that. So the Vedangas, the 6 books, the next 6, those are all the technicalities on how to approach the Vedas. In other words, the grammar, the whole Sanskrit language, how you approach it. That's 4 books. Then you're going to perform, then you're going to use that in ritual. That's the kalpa. So that's all kinds of, that's all the ritual that's in your whole life. And it also then includes the jyotish, which will tell the times for doing those things. So it's all like the hard sciences. Right? But that's not actually the art of the application, the personal understanding. So then the upangas, technically, then the Mimamsa gives you actually how to interpret the Veda and all the other elements. How you're going to use your Sanskrit, your ritual, the Jyotish. How you're going to choose. In other words, what's the angle of vision you're actually going to look at the Vedas from? Right. So, technically, you can it's you have the brahmanas, aranyakas, means in other words you have the ritual, you have the metaphysical, you have the spiritual. So that would be of the Vedas, the four parts. But to bring that out, then the Mimamsa makes it specific. Right? Then you have to you have a language, you have a philosophy, but its presentation must be clear. Otherwise there's going to be no communication. Therefore logic. Right? Then Dharma Shastra means based on the Vedas, what is actually the lifestyle, you know, of someone who follows this. So all the rules of Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha are given. You know, what is actually the way, means the person who follows the Vedas, what would be their lifestyle? What is their value system? So all that's there, but that's like the core element that is to be gotten across, the philosophy and the the rules of proper, you know, culture. So your philosophy and culture, this is what Vedic education is for. The other things are what you gain these from. In other words, it's from the Vedas. Then you have the technicalities, how you can access the Vedas, right, through the Sanskrit and the ritual and all that, and apply it. But the understanding that actually is your life, your value system, then that is given by the philosophy and culture. Right? Does that make sense? So the philosophy is supported by the logic, the culture is supported by the example given in the Puranic literature. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's why it has to be complete. So if you have the philosophy but no culture, then you'll be plagued by speculation because there's no tradition to hold it down. Right? And if you have religion but no philosophy, then you'll behave very nicely, but it'll be sentimental because you don't actually know what the ultimate goal of that culture is. Right? To go back to Godhead. So the other is you know how to go back to Godhead, but you don't know how to behave with those who are also going back to Godhead. Right? So that will create social speculation. Right? Does that make sense? So then it's a problem. Like that. So so those 10 books are in support so that you actually understand. You know, so for us, then we said the philosophy and culture, but the Bhagavatam is written in such a way that it's the perfect blend of the essence of the philosophy and the culture. So just by that one book, you actually get the benefit of all the 14 books. Okay? So then all of our literature then is written based on the Bhagavatam. Right? Like that. So that's how then we approach. The Bhagavatam is the essence of the Vedic literatures, then we expand the Bhagavatam to bring out the meaning there. Though to do that, we will give reference from the Vedic literatures and that, so it's all authoritative. Like that. So then that way we make that connection between Bhagavatam and everything else and how it's the essence. Is that okay? Didn't we give that to Devesha? You didn't get the paper? Where is that paper? Yeah. We have the other 10. We will get back to that. So in the meantime, a word from our sponsor. There is not a story current in this world, but doth depend upon this history, even as body upon the food it taketh. All poets cherish the Bharata, even as servants desirous of preferment always attend upon masters of good lineage. Even as the blessed domestic ashrama can never be surpassed by the three other ashramas, modes of life, so no poets can surpass this poem. So this is a very interesting point, because in the hierarchy we'll put sannyas on the top, but to make the system work, it's dependent upon the grihastha ashram. So therefore, in one sense, the grihastha ashram is taken as the superior ashram. because from grihasthas you get brahmacharis who become grihasthas. The grihasthas themselves retire to become vanaprasthas and sannyasis. Does that make sense? So the whole varnashram system, all the money is generated by the grihasthas, all the charity is distributed by them, all the management, everything that goes on, you know, all the ritual, everything is going on by them. So if you want to have social system, the varnashram, you need them. Right? If you want to act outside of that, then you don't need, right? You can be a sage in the forest and not have anything to do with anything else. Then that's fine, but you don't really have a social structure. You just have basic Vaishnava etiquette. Does that make sense? So the whole varnashram is dependent upon the grihasthas. So in that way, they're taken as senior or superior. So that's why, even though renunciation is superior, those within the renounced orders respect the grihasthas because of their actually creating the whole environment in which the whole system can function. Right? Does that make sense? But at the same time as the grihasthas, knowing that the goal is to get out of that situation of attachment to detachment, they respect the other three orders of detachment. That way then there's the natural balance. Each performs their duties, each respects the other. Like that. So then, okay, O Brahmana, authorities on the matter understand a Purana to contain 10 characteristic topics. The creation of this universe, the subsequent creation of worlds and beings, right? So that would be the primary and secondary. The maintenance of all living beings, their sustenance, the rule of various manus, the dynasty of great kings, the activities of such kings, annihilation, motivation, and the supreme shelter. Other scholars state that great Puranas deal with these 10 topics, while lesser Puranas may deal with 5. The 10 subjects of a great Purana are also described in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10.1. Right, that was from 12th canto, the first verse. And this is from the purport. Sukadeva Goswami said, in the Srimad Bhagavatam there are 10 divisions of statements regarding the following: the creation of the universe, sub-creation, planetary systems, protection by the Lord, the creative impetus, the change of manus, the science of God, returning home, back to Godhead, liberation, and the summum bonum. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, Puranas such as Srimad Bhagavatam deal with these 10 topics, whereas lesser Puranas deal with only 5, as stated in the Vedic literature. Sargas cha, prati sargas cha, vamso, man mantarani cha, vamsanucharitam cheti puranam panchalakshanam. Creation, secondary creation, the dynasty of kings, the reigns of manas, and the activities of various dynasties are the 5 characteristics of a Purana. Puranas covering 5 categories of knowledge are understood to be secondary Puranic literature. Srila Jiva Goswami has explained that the 10 principal topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are found within each of the 12 cantos. One should not try to assign each of the 10 topics to a particular canto, nor should the Srimad Bhagavatam be artificially interpreted to show that it deals with the topic successively. The simple fact is that all aspects of knowledge important to human beings, summarized in the 10 categories mentioned above, are described with various degrees of emphasis and analysis throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay? You can see from here that it, Vamso means the dynasty of kings. In here would be meaning also starting from the Prajapatis. So it gets down to the kings, but it starts with the Prajapatis. Right? So that would show Prajapatis going down into the kings. Then there's the specific activities of the kings. Right? So that then you can understand that as the connection between and the other ones, why it doesn't specifically say the Prajapatis? Right, the dynasty of great kings, the activities of kings. So they'll say that. So the dynasty of kings means all of them going back to the Prajapatis. Right? Okay. Does that make sense?
Is the incarnations included in the maintenance?
Say again?
The topic of incarnations.
Incarnations,
maintenance?
Yeah. Like that. Because the Lord maintains the universe through his pastimes, actually, coming in like that. So you'll get the activities of the Purusha avatars, then of the Lila avatars, the Manvantaras, this, that. So you can get the specific pastime, but then you get the whole concept of how they interact and everything like that. Does that make sense? Okay. Then, continue here. Is that okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Then, ye ascetics, shake off all inaction. Right? Let your hearts be fixed on virtue. For virtue is the one only friend of him that hath gone to the other world. Even the most intelligent, by cherishing wealth and wives, can never make these their own, nor are these possessions lasting. The Bharata uttered by the lips of Dwaipayana is without a parallel. It is virtue itself and sacred. It destroyeth sin and protecteth good. He that listeneth to it while it is being recited hath no need of a bath in the sacred waters of Pushkar. A Brahmana, whatever sins he may commit during the day through his senses, is free from them by reading the Bharata in the evening. Whatever sins he may committeth also in the night by deeds, words, or mind, he is freed from them all by reading Bharata in the first twilight morning. He that giveth a hundredth kine with horns mounted with gold to a Brahmana well posted up in the Vedas and all branches of learning, and he that daily listeneth to the sacred narrations of the Bharata, acquire equal merit. Right? As the wide ocean is easily passable by men having ships, so is this extensive history of great excellence and deep import with the help of this chapter called Parva Sangraha. Thus endeth the section called Parva Sangraha of the Adi Parva of the blessed Mahabharata. So he's saying is here that virtue is the only thing that goes with you. When you die, your wealth, your family, no one goes with you. You can never actually own them, right? In this world, possession is very, very important, right? Who's in control, right? I think we discussed that this morning. So, but you can never actually fully possess, right, anything of this world. So even though your money and your family is so dear to you, still you can't fully possess it because you will lose it, right? But virtue, in other words, proper activities, will go with you to the next life, right? So now, of all virtue, Krishna consciousness is the most virtuous. So that's the most important, yes. Are girls more possessive than boys, and if so, why? Yes. Why? We have to remember that everything in this world is a reflection of the spiritual world, right? That's how we can actually understand the culture. So in the spiritual world, male means Krishna. So he's independent. So technically, he's unattached because he is, right? Meaning he exists, you know. Now, feminine means his energy, which expands. And energy is automatically dependent. Does that make sense? It cannot be independent. It's automatically dependent. So therefore, possession means the continuity or continuation of one's existence. If it's yours, then you have it. So existence actually is the problem or is the focus of the feminine, right? Because they are opulence. You know, so they are opulence, therefore they like to be in an environment of opulence. Right, but opulence is also not cared for. Right, they have so many saris in their closet, but how many of them do they actually care for? If you pull them out, oh, then they care for it. Possession is there, but they'll just forget about them because opulence is just something they have. Right, but you see, the man, he has his little gizmos and gadgets, and he always has them, and he's always there and playing with them, and this, and you know, like that. He'll pull the things out of the top cabinet behind the pictures and pull them out and look at them, and you know, stuff like that. So, you know, now and again, just you know, they're there, yes, you know. But the lady, it's just you know, yes, great. Oh, I always wanted that. Then it goes, puts away, and never thought about it again. right? Until there's so many of them that they break the cabinet, right? And you have to spend, you know, $75,000 remaking their walk-in, you know, wardrobe. Like that. You know, up to now, everything I said have been taken from real life situations. So, so then, yeah. So, therefore, existence is their main focus, like that of what they have to have. Right? Does that make sense? So, then that possession is the most necessary for them. So, it's natural. And if it's done in, if that possession is done in a way that it is in care of the other person or the other object, then actually it's very nice. That's what's attractive about the women, is that possessiveness, but for the benefit of the other. In other words, when it's extended sense gratification, pranamoy instead of anamoy, their own particular thing. So, but, yeah, does that make sense? But for rasa, then we see the man becomes dependent upon the woman. Then there's the element of possession, but it's for rasa. It's not for existence. Right? Means if he's dependent upon the woman for existence, that means his masculinity needs to mature more. Right? It's not as mature as it should be. But for the interaction, the emotional interaction and that kind of those feelings, then there's dependency upon the women, right? But they can still not function in that, right? Because for liberation you don't need that. So that's what also then makes their position superior to the women, in that when it comes to getting out of the universe, then that's easy for them. Because if they just withdraw the emotional need, then they are independent. They aren't dependent upon anything. But that's what the Grihastha Ashram is for, is to engage that emotional need so that it can be withdrawn at the time of leaving this world. Does that make some sense? Means what they possess, they should be satisfied with. In other words, their existence can be defined through what little they have. And if they have more, you can expand that. But it's not that there's any lack. Their existence is not able to be defined. You know what I'm saying? So even if they just have, you know, 3 saris, still they have saris, they have clothes. Then if they're satisfied with that, they'll be happy. Because otherwise, then, you know, then from 3, then there seems to be somewhere around 10 to 15 is the next kind of place. Then there's around 30 to 50 is the next kind of category. Then I've heard the next category is around 250. Then there's 500. I haven't heard beyond that, because probably no one's either haven't moved in those circles, or they just didn't want to reveal the truth. You know, the 500 categories where you have to start remaking your walk-in, you know, wardrobes. Like that. So, but you see in all of them, the satisfaction of any of the woman is the same. There's no difference. She has 500, but still, she's checking out. She's got saris that no one else has seen. She's probably not even worn them, probably never will wear them, but she has them, right? The possession is there. But she's still checking out what every other lady is wearing, right? Somebody walks by and, oh, I don't have that one, right? You know? So satisfaction is based on, if you're smart, happiness is the attainment of something you want. Now, if that's all the farther you go, the attainment of it, how long does it last? How long does the ecstasy of gaining something last? Does that make sense? It's not so long. Yeah, it's basically a moment. You can stretch it out with a little party and a little laughing and, you know, turn on some music and do some dancing and this and get out something to, you know, nibble on, or, you know, something to, you know, some visuals or this and that. You can extend it a little bit, right? But ultimately, it's gone. But now, satisfaction is the way you can maintain that happiness. happiness, I got it. But satisfaction is, I have it. You understand? So therefore, possessiveness and satisfaction aren't opposed to each other. It's just a matter of being happy with what you have, rather than happiness is defined on gaining what I don't have. Because otherwise then the heart becomes so agitated you can never become satisfied. It's just not. It means what you have, if it's natural, it comes, it's there. Otherwise there's someone who always has something you don't have. Always. You know, and it's not even that it's necessarily appropriate, right? It's, let's say the person has a big family, right? And somebody else has this two-seater, you know, sports car. You don't have one of those. You'd like to have it, but what are you going to do with it? You have six people in your family. They will not fit in the two-seater car, right? Does that make sense? You know, I mean, I guess you could put a few on the dashboard or something like that. Or, you know, someone can hold on to the air intake. Yeah, a couple can hold on to the spoiler, some onto the air intake. You know, I'd rather have the air intake, right? There's holes you can get your fingers on. The spoiler's kind of like this. You might slide off, you know? Unless it's a wing. If it's a wing, then it's okay. That you can hold on to. A rack. Okay, yeah, that would be interesting. You know, a rack on top of your Lamborghini Diablo. It might be a problem when you open the door, though, like that, and have the thin rack. You know? Unless, of course, yeah, it means, unless, of course, what you mean by that is putting the wife on the roof. Okay, so, yeah, so therefore you'll eat your heart out away, but there's no practical meaning for it, right? You're only going to put your, because what you need is something that's big that you can put your whole family in, right? So then, of course, then you could get into the, you know, 4x4, you know, Porsche or something. Yes, that you could do. But the two-seater, you know, 911 or, you know, like that, forget about it, right? Does that make sense? Because otherwise, there's always something that someone else has, right? But you know, all you have to do is remember. Okay, that one has a set of shoes you don't have. But then think about how many shoes you have, and do you actually use them all? Right? That's the whole point. So even if you have it, it won't increase your happiness. So the only actually key to happiness is satisfaction. And if the woman is satisfied, then it's not that just she becomes happy. Actually, everyone in her circle becomes happy. Because others, the other members of the family can actually only be happy when the central, you know, female in the house is happy. Right? So when she's satisfied, that means all the men, the children, the friends, the relatives, anybody that's connected to them, they can be happy also. So it's actually a great social welfare work for all humanity, for women to really work hard at being satisfied. Yes? It goes way beyond anything else that you can do, right? Yes.
Yes, yes, okay, Jonathan.
Yes, yes, okay, Jagatsu Kami. Yeah, you heard that? Say it loudly. No, loudly, say the Sanskrit.
Yes, yes, okay,
Jagatsu Kami. Jagatsu Kami, right? If the wife is happy, the whole universe is happy. That's the... And factually speaking, one may say it's an exaggeration, but the men, actually that's how they feel. You know, to get a smile on the face of a woman, it's as good as conquering the universe. Like that. How you say? There's a saying, the sun will rise again tomorrow. Means you guys are laughing now at what's the other grihasthas, but tomorrow the sun will rise upon your family life. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so then we'll end here. Jai Ho. Who do we say here? Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Srila Prabhupada Hare Ki Jai. Because you know where it is, right? You printed this out, no?
Yeah, I made that a few years ago.
Oh, okay.